Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
We've watched as the world has watched us, wondering whether Sweden is playing Russian roulette with its 10 million citizens.
The empty streets at the start of this year gave everyone time to take a breath, and every side of the political spectrum has emerged relatively unscathed.
Older East Berliners joke that the queues in front of shops now are like those in the not-so-long-ago communist era, this time with more space and better manners.
The way a city handles a pandemic says a lot about its character. So, what are some of the lessons to be learned from this period? This week, we've asked Monocle's correspondents to send over letters from their outposts as urban centres start to reopen around the world and a new normal settles in. That's all coming up right here in the next 30 minutes on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to this week's episode. We'll start in Sweden. The country's controversial approach to the pandemic made headlines around the world. So, was it a sensible or a stupid decision? Our Stockholm correspondent, Liv Lewicznik, wrote this letter from her city.
Get on the metro in Stockholm and you might wonder whether anyone has heard of coronavirus. People are sitting far apart, but keeping away from strangers on public transport and elsewhere is normal behaviour for Swedes. If you walk through the city centre, you'll see people out and about. The sun has finally arrived after the long dark winter and people have emerged to enjoy it. The authorities have had to tell some restaurants off for letting their customers sit too close together. But other than that, it looks as though it's almost business as usual. Figures back this up. Consumer spending isn't down in Sweden nearly as much as it is in its Nordic neighbours. We've watched as the world has watched us, wondering whether Sweden is playing Russian roulette with its 10 million citizens. Unlike just about everywhere else, Sweden chose to tackle the pandemic through a strategy of cautious common sense. Individuals are asked to take certain measures, but there are no penalties if they don't. Depending on your viewpoint, the government is either a bastion of strong liberal values and resistance to panic, or it's exhibiting a cool disregard for human life. Every evening, the nation listens to the latest from the state epidemiologist Anders Tegnell on the news. The public health authority has resisted widespread pressure and criticism from abroad to respond more harshly to the virus. Tegnell has had his critics even here, but this is a country that still believes in experts, and most are happy to leave it in his hands. Swedes do feel anxious about the outbreak and fear the effects of a global recession. Numerous companies are either struggling financially or on the brink of bankruptcy. The crisis has also made us rethink how we interact. Neighbours are offering to shop for those in high-risk groups in their own Swedish way. In my building's lift, someone has taped up an obsessively detailed spreadsheet to fill in if you need help. So, while we avoid sharing a lift with our neighbours, that's nothing new, we can feel their presence in a new way. Once this is over, we can hopefully celebrate that the elements that make up the Swedish psyche work well in a crisis. Level-headedness, openness, and a built-in readiness to help out when things get hairy.
That was Monocle's Stockholm correspondent, Liv Lewicznik. Now to Hong Kong. The city needs time to recover, but according to our bureau chief, James Chambers, now might be its chance for a proper turnaround.
So, what next for Hong Kong? Well, I vote for democracy. I'm dead serious. Just hear me out. I'd like to see the next 3 months turn into a battle of ideas and ideologies at the ballot box. Rather than return to last year's pitched battles between protesters and the police, I want to see Lenin walls covered in election leaflets, canvas campaign ads draped over what's left of the roadside railings, and wannabe politicians standing on every graffitied street corner, microphone in hand, shouting political slogans and belting out karaoke. Don't worry, I've not lost all grip on reality during quarantine. This is what democracy in Hong Kong is actually like. And after a year of protests and the pandemic, this divided city could really get behind a good old-fashioned election. Voters in Hong Kong may not get to choose their leader or chief executive, hence the ruckus last year, but they can elect members of the Legislative Council, a mini-lawmaking body commonly known as LegCo. The next LegCo election is due in September, and the pro-democracy side has a genuine chance to win control for the first time, despite the system being skewed against them. Hong Kong's chief executive doesn't belong to any of these political parties, so Carrie Lam would have to work with whomever commands the biggest share of LegCo. Right now, that's her traditional allies from the pro-Beijing camp. But a heavy defeat in local elections last year has the establishment well and truly rattled. COVID-19 has actually cleared the stage for this September showdown. The empty streets at the start of this year have given everyone time to take a breath, and every side of the political spectrum has emerged relatively unscathed. Beijing respected one country, two systems by leaving the chief executive in charge of public health, with impressive results. Meanwhile, the mask-wearing protesters suddenly found themselves becoming model citizens overnight. With strategy documents being updated during this hiatus, here's my friendly advice for each camp. First up, the pro-democracy protesters. Rushing back out onto the streets won't guarantee you the same level of public support. Society needs time to recover, both economically and emotionally. Take the long-term view, and the next 3 months will fly by. Some of you can stand for election, and the rest of you can get out the vote. Protests are a part of life in Hong Kong, but stay disciplined and stick to the big dates. People power over petrol bombs. And secondly, the Hong Kong government. Hold on to that antibacterial hand gel and use it to wipe the slate clean. Talk to the electorate this time. Take the police out of politics and build on your remarkable success in containing COVID-19. Holding free and fair elections is the best way to show the international community that the rule of law is still alive and well in Hong Kong. And you can always take the fight to those umbrella-waving pan-democrats at the ballot box. And as for Beijing, forget about 5,000 years of history for 1 minute and just look at what happened in January. Attempts to bully voters in Taiwan backfired on you in a big way, and now you're at it again in Hong Kong, creating a constitutional firestorm and interfering in local politics right before they head to the polls. Hong Kong needs your economic support to recover from COVID-19, just like it did after SARS. So start behaving more like a benevolent dictator and less like a thin-skinned tyrant. So, will any of this actually happen? Of course not. Don't be daft. The protests have already begun. Beijing is busy stoking the fire as we speak. And June will be a lightning rod as the one-year anniversary of the start of last year's mayhem. Who knows if the election in September will even go ahead? For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm James Chambers.
We continue to New York now, a city that's been bearing the brunt of the pandemic in the United States. But if one thing became clear, it's the importance of having proper local and state leadership in the face of a federal government described as frustrating at best. Here's our America's editor-at-large, Ed Stocker.
Walking around my Brooklyn neighborhood, there are signs of solidarity everywhere. In the windows of brownstones are rainbows drawn by children and messages of support for first responders. One neighbour, Stacy, has strung a poster from her railing, offering to help coordinate shopping, food runs and transportation for the neediest. It's these glimpses of humanity in a city at the global epicentre of the pandemic that provide a ray of hope. This city will get back to normal, but the question remains when. Coronavirus has exposed certain ills, many of which could be applied to the country as a whole. There will certainly be questions to resolve about inequality and why the city's minority populations, as well as its poorest, have been disproportionately affected by coronavirus. So too, the fragility of the gig economy, where all the advantages are stacked in the favour of the business owner. New York's governor, Andrew Cuomo, has signalled that he wants to take a slowly approach to reopening. And so the buzz of bars and restaurants crammed with people, part of what makes this city most vital, might not be a sight for some time yet. It's hard to see how a physically distanced restaurant model might work here, where sky-high rents dictate that tightly packed tables are needed to make a business viable. But perhaps New Yorkers' love of takeaway may help. Normally, frantic New York has had time to slow down and take stock. Mayor Bill de Blasio has said that he wants to shut off up to 160 kilometers of the city's streets to traffic to allow New Yorkers space to exercise. Perhaps a silver lining from this pandemic will be a radical rethinking of shared public space. It's a lifeline for New Yorkers, coronavirus or no coronavirus. For Monocle in New York, I'm Ed Stocker.
Up next, we're off to Berlin. Known for its outsized party scene, this resilient city is already hoping for a comeback, as our correspondent Kimberly Bradley reports. Let's have a listen.
A hush fell over the city when Berlin's most notorious draws closed abruptly. Mega clubs, opera houses, museums, galleries, theaters, not to mention its hotels, retail outlets, and schools. As time passed, there was some reassurance in seeing that Germany in general, and Berlin in particular, would be spared the sky-high mortality rates of northern Italy and then New York. Through it all, our celebrity virologist Christian Drosten soothed us with frequent podcasts describing the situation.
In diese Richtung, dass mehr asymptomatisch getestet wird.
But how would the German capital, whose economy leans so heavily on tourism and small business, survive? The city answered the last question quickly, with grants ranging from 5,000 euros for freelancers to 15,000 euros for companies with up to 10 employees. Tens of thousands filled out an easy online form and received the money 2 days later. At the moment, Berlin's coronavirus numbers remain moderate. The temporary corona clinic erected within Berlin's fairgrounds has not yet been used, despite talk of a second wave. Some restrictions have been loosened. The first non-essential shops and even some small museums are reopening. Pupils taking entrance or graduation exams returned to school in shifts on April 27th, but wearing a mask became compulsory on public transport. With large gatherings forbidden until at least October, the party scene, hedonism being the city's hallmark, might be forever changed. Culture and hospitality too. People are rightly nervous about their futures, and some worried that testing, curfews, and surveillance represent a return to the less savory parts of Germany's past. But many others are also discussing how this reset can be steered to make the best of Berlin's assets, openness, innovation, and resilience, and create new and better systems. As to Berlin's remarkable resilience, this city has endured harder knocks than this. In the past century, it's been bombed, locked down, occupied, and more. Berliners got through by diligently rebuilding, adapting, and creating informal support systems. Older East Berliners joke that the queues in front of shops now are like those in the not-so-long-ago communist era, this time with more space and better manners. I hope that Berlin takes the best of this period and runs with it. A car-free city center, easier support for entrepreneurs and creatives, maybe converting now less-needed office space into much-needed housing. One can dream. When it's safe for mega parties again, Berlin will probably throw the ultimate one as it decides what it wants to be next. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
Thank you, Kimberly. That was Kimberly Bradley in Berlin. And this is The Urbanist. And up next, it's time for us to look to London. I don't know. What can we say? We know that we said it would be all okay. And look, it could still turn out how we hoped. But yes, we admit it. Sometimes we are worried. Those empty streets may make for brooding posts on Instagram, but all that silence, it just doesn't suit your outgoing style. When we think of our best times together, well, there's usually a chorus to accompany the moment. Sometimes soft, the murmur in a restaurant from diners sharing their secrets, or louder, the cacophony that rises into the air from drinkers outside a pub on a summer's evening, just as the long, wistful shadows stripe your buildings. And then there's the roar of victory, a celebration, a demonstration. But this silence, it's a silence that should not define any city, and dear London, especially you. Your shops are shuttered, boarded up with such intent that you wonder if their owners ever intend to return. Other store windows are frozen in time, displays of clothes slowly edging out of fashion with each passing day. There are signs that offer rooms for hire for birthday parties, advertise the price of haircuts and manicures, and list dishes of the day. But they're all relics, mementos of a time that slipped past us. A time we took for granted, a time that now seems hard to conjure up some days. Do you fancy a drink after work? Or we could grab a table and eat at that nice place just round the corner. Did we used to say such things? People talk of the new normal, declare how happy they are, declare that the hum of industry and trade was the nuisance all along. But that is to misunderstand you. For centuries, you've been the holder of dreams, the stage on which dramas could play out, the city where hammer, cook's knife, and market traders' call have carried in their echo the promise of a deal, a few pounds profit, and an excitement, a celebratory toast, a hand clasped, and a back slapped in joy. But now it's just quiet. We wait for victory over this virus, but we're tilting at an enemy that always seems to be edging away from us. So for now, we will have to live with small yet audible markers of hope. In the afternoon air, you can hear construction sites back in banging action. More cafes have opened for takeaway trade, and the traffic edges up in quantity and purr. But it's not enough. You need everyone back, and somehow, in some way, you need people to once again be able to stand shoulder to shoulder and say, "This is my city, this is where I live, and I will not endure this sleepwalking forever." This has to be a resolution. Because in the end, a city thrives because people do not stay at home. So we watch and we wait, but yes, sometimes we're worried for you. Let's turn our gaze to Tokyo now. 2020 was meant to be this city's year as it played host to the Olympic Games. Perhaps caught by surprise by the way the world came to a standstill, our bureau chief Fiona Wilson explains how a lack of guidance during the pandemic has meant that citizens were basically left to work out for themselves what to do. Here she is.
Tokyo seems to have been out of sorts, or at least not quite its usual self, for months now. The virus appeared here in the middle of January, and uncertainty has been hanging in the air ever since. While cities in other countries went into abrupt lockdowns, Tokyo moved more languorously into the slow lane. Schools were the first to close, but after that startlingly decisive move, the general wind down took weeks. The Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, and Yuriko Koike, the governor of Tokyo, squabbled over the terms of the shutdown. Koike was calling for tough measures, while Abe was reluctant to take a sledgehammer to the economy. In the absence of clear guidance, citizens have largely been left to work out for themselves what to do. Bigger corporations, institutions, and retail chains all closed, but small businesses that couldn't afford to took matters into their own hands, Restaurants and cafes switched to takeaway, and many small shops have stayed open. People have settled into Tokyo's slower pace, working from home, enjoying onnomi, or online drinking parties, with friends, and revisiting prescient works like Akira, the 1980s manga set in post-apocalyptic Tokyo.
Akira no toko e itta?
So itte ta wa, ano ko ga.
Ami mo omae ya Ryu tachi mo sono Akira tteu yatsu o sagashitete, sore de tetsu o okkaketeru.
Peace and quiet is not Tokyo's natural mode, but it suits the city surprisingly well. The virus has forced Japan to experiment with a less brutal work culture, and there may yet be some residual impact. Japan hasn't been aggressive about testing or lockdown, and yet its infection numbers have not exploded. Since the health service started creaking almost immediately, it's just as well. If Japan does emerge from this in decent physical, if not economic, shape, it will be thanks to the goodwill and common sense of its population as much as any skilled political strategy. For Monocle in Tokyo, I'm Fiona Wilson.
Next, a letter from Vienna. Small shops and businesses have started to reopen, and while people are still taking precautions, there are some lessons to be learned from the way that Austria has handled the pandemic. Here's our city letter from our Vienna contributor, Alexei Korolev.
There is a famous saying attributed to the Austrian composer Gustav Mahler: if the world comes to an end, I shall go to Vienna. Everything happens 50 years later there. This wasn't really true in his time, nor is it true in ours. Austria was one of the first countries in Europe to follow Italy in imposing a strict lockdown. It was also among the first to start easing those restrictions. The government still advises caution, of course, and stringent hygiene measures are in place in shops and public offices, but all in all, life here feels almost normal. In fact, as I record this, there's a classical music concert in my garden in support of all those affected by the pandemic. This isn't, strictly speaking, normal, either to me or my neighbours, but neither does it feel extraordinary, despite the black-frocked musicians wearing masks and the audience hiding in the bushes. Perhaps that is what Gustav Mahler meant by Austrian backwardness. Austrians are, by nature, a rather conservative bunch, both in obeying orders and in maintaining their way of life, and no crisis is ever going to change that. This innate conservatism also explains why people here have been so eager to support local producers and local talent. If you buy from Amazon, I will unfriend you, is a common exchange on Austrian social media these days. From day one of the lockdown, the Viennese weekly Falter ran a list of all Austrian shops, designers and craftspeople that sold their goods online. This buy local movement has also been encouraged by the government, whose handling of the outbreak has been praised by most of the population. No mean feat in a country that loves to grumble. But it has also claimed its political casualties and rekindled the age-old debate about Austrian nationalism. Last week, Ulrike Lunacek, the State Secretary for Arts and Culture, became the first senior figure to leave the conservative Green government of Chancellor Sebastian Kurz. She didn't understand the needs of artists in the crisis, was the verdict. Chancellor Kurz has also come in for some criticism, not least for his rhetoric. Like many conservative leaders before him, he makes a point of using the phrase
"Liebe Österreicherinnen und Österreicher,"
dear Austrians, when addressing the nation. But why does he never mention the country's considerable non-Austrian communities?
Guten Abend, liebe Österreicherinnen und Österreicher und alle, die hier leben.
Thankfully, we have Alexander van der Bellen. Typically, it's been the president, the wise old man, who's been able to find comforting words for all. The worst of the outbreak in Austria is over. Here in Vienna, it's business as usual. There will be more crises, but if this one is anything to go by, I'm proud to be living in Austria. Even if it's unlikely that Chancellor Sebastian Kurz will ever include me in his good wishes. For Monocle, I'm Alexei Korolev.
And finally, on today's programme, we're in Toronto. Monocle's bureau chief, Thomas Lewis, pens a letter on the signs scattered around his city and how they've been a kind of rallying cry, uplifting sentiments in an unpredictable time. Here he is.
Toronto, like many places, has become a city of signs over the past 9 weeks or so, since the city was placed in a state of lockdown in the middle of March. Some of them, handwritten on little strips of card or typed out on sheets of paper and pasted in the windows of shops and restaurants temporarily shuttered, have been to the point and have stated the obvious, saying things like "closed until further notice" or "we'll see you soon." Others have been slightly more ominous. One of our go-to coffee spots near Monocle's Toronto bureau here in the Little Italy neighbourhood states, in white ink painted directly onto the glass of the front door, that it is, and I quote, "closed for apocalypse," the round outline of a face with two dots for the eyes and a sad, upturned smile painted next to the words, just to hammer home the point. Most of the signs, however, have been a kind of rallying cry, uplifting sentiments in an unpredictable time. Some of the smaller theatres and cinemas have put words of encouragement on their awnings. "Be kind, be safe, be strong," were the words spelled out in theatre billboard letters on the front of the Lower Ossington Theatre, not far from where I live, the day after the lockdown came into force. And there are painted rainbows in the windows of apartments and houses here too, and messages of support and gratitude to Toronto's hospital workers, pasted in living room windows, posted on placards in front gardens, and even strung across the fences of one of the most popular parks in Toronto's West End. But the most common of the signs still in the windows of many businesses here is one that chimes particularly with the city of Toronto. Not necessarily for what it says, although the words, "we're all in this together," have certainly been quietly galvanising in an uncertain time, but for how the sign says it. Printed in jaunty, lively lettering that scrolls up and down the page, the words are rendered in red, yellow and blue, and are a warm-hearted pastiche of the hand-painted price tags that were ubiquitous at Honest Ed's, Toronto's fabled discount department store, which closed a few years ago to be redeveloped. The lettering, however, is one of the most recognisable and nostalgic pieces of Toronto's visual identity still. Back then, when Honest Ed's was still peddling its cut-price wares, each sign was hand-painted by the sign painter Wayne Rubin, who remains a city treasure here in his own right, proclaiming the price for each of the thousands of products inside, from bras to baked beans, from sports shoes to indigestion tablets. The "We Are All In This Together" signs now, painted to reflect the comfort a place like Honest Ed's brought generations of Torontonians, have been a welcome reminder that, while cities around the world have gone through a similar experience over the past 2 months, Toronto's response to a moment of crisis, true to the collective spirit of the place, will be Toronto's own. That sentiment, however, has had a bit of a shadow cast over it over the past few weeks. Many of the shops which have stuck those signs to their windows while they've been closed have been threatened with closure themselves. Not because of the enforced lockdown. The provincial and federal governments here have invested millions of dollars to help businesses weather the outbreak, but because of the landlords in whose buildings those businesses sit. A battle is forming here between commercial landlords and their tenants, some of whom own some of the most storied small independent businesses in Toronto. The owners of Glad Day, for example, the world's oldest bookshop devoted to LGBT literature, which opened in the 1970s and remains one of the best speciality bookshops in the city, warned a few weeks ago that the owners of the building in which it resides had opted not to sign up for the government help that was designed to help them by offering to pay commercial landlords 75% of the rent their tenants would usually pay them. While a ban on residential evictions during the lockdown has been put in place here, a similar ban hasn't been implemented for commercial property, like that that's been instituted in London, for example. Some commercial landlords, it seems, would prefer to allow their existing tenants to go out of business, so they'll be able to charge the next tenant whatever they like for their retail spaces. If that's allowed to run unchecked, and the landlords are allowed to effectively force their tenants to shut up shop for good and charge whatever they like for the next tenant, the kinds of businesses that will be able to afford those rent prices will be ones that don't reflect the independent entrepreneurial spirit that make Toronto's neighbourhoods so mixed, so diverse, and such a joyous place to be. Toronto prides itself on being a city of neighbourhoods. Without the small independent shops that make each corner of the city so distinct and so full of life, it isn't a claim the city will be able to boast for long. On Tuesday this week, some shops here began to reopen, most for now by appointment only, or by allowing one customer in at a time to the store, depending on how big the shop in question is. And as more of Toronto's shops reopen, so I guess those signs will eventually, one by one, be taken out of the windows. But the spirit captured by those colourful sheets of paper will, I hope, linger, particularly for the owners of the bakeries, the bookshops, the record stores and the watering holes, who've been buffeted not only by the outbreak, but by their landlords too. It's vital that the bargain stated in those signs is made good by City Hall, by local leaders, by those who hold the checkbooks, because if Toronto is to emerge from this in the same spirit that it went into it, we do have to make sure that we really are all in this together. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Well, we first did these letters from our correspondents, from our bureau chiefs at the start of the pandemic. And already the story has changed and evolved and developed in different ways in different places. And it's great to have checked in with so many of our key people around the world today. And you can see that some places are racing ahead. If you're in Vienna, life feels very different from here in London. But perhaps there's more optimism and more of a plan falling in place in most cities now than there was just a few weeks ago. So we're all hopeful that civic leaders have begun to get their heads around what needs to be done. But more importantly, that we have, that we understand that as we edge back out, as we open stores and cafes and we go back into parks and we lay in the sun, that we have a job to continue doing. So to all of you in your cities around the world, I hope things are improving for you. Thank you also for all your notes and letters that have come to us about this show and about what Monocle has been trying to chart over recent weeks. We're going to stay with this story. We want to remain optimistic and open-minded about what the future holds. But as always, stay safe. And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, well, it's a bit cheesy, but hey, here's the Marvelettes with Please, Mr. Postman. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.